This is Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host for the American Counseling Association's 2009 podcast series. Today we are speaking with Dr. Howard Kirschenbaum, who is Professor Emeritus and former Chair of Counseling and Human Development at the Warner Graduate School of Education at the University of Rochester in New York. Dr. Kirschenbaum is the author of more than 20 books on education, counseling, and history. He is a recognized expert on Carl Rogers, having written the earlier biography on becoming Carl Rogers. He was also co-editor of the Carl Rogers Reader and Carl Rogers Dialogues, and the writer and producer of the DVD Carl Rogers and the Person-Centered Approach. But more importantly, Dr. Kirschenbaum was a respected and trusted colleague of Carl Rogers. Today we are discussing Dr. Kirschenbaum's new book, The Life and Work of Carl Rogers. Welcome, Dr. Kirschenbaum.
Thank you, Rebecca.
I read your book and found it fascinating. The first question that came to mind was, since you wrote what was considered the definitive biography of Carl Rogers 30 years ago, what's different about this one?
Well, several things are different. First of all, the previous biography ended in 1977 when Rogers still had 10 more years to live. And those last 10 years were among his most productive and important work in his life. It included expanding the person-centered, client-centered approach into cross-cultural communication and conflict resolution and international peacekeeping, work for which he was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. So it was very important to update the biography to include these final years and make it a complete study of his life and work. A second way that the biography is different is that in the last decade or two, some of the private papers of Rogers became available. These were papers at the Library of Congress and at the University of California at Santa Barbara, including restricted papers and diaries that I was given access to. So between those papers and new interviews that I conducted with his colleagues and family, some of his closest associates of the last decade or two of his life, I was able to uncover much more information than really anybody knew about Rogers, including myself, having written the biography earlier. So it turned out that these papers and these interviews revealed a much more complex person, someone who had some real struggles and internal issues he was dealing with that reveal a human being in all his complexity that makes for a much more interesting story, I think, than the more one-dimensional figure that a very positive figure, but a more singular dimensional character than I or others had previously described. I guess the third.
Can you give us an example of something you discovered that increased the complexity with which we look at Carl Rogers?
Yes. For example, Rogers struggled with alcohol through the last 40 years of his life.
Mm-hmm.
He had a dependency mm-hmm. that I could go into some detail about that now, or we could come back to it, but that would be an example. I'll just stop there, and if you'd like to pursue it a little bit later, we can.
Mm-hmm.
But that's just one of several areas that showed it was a more interesting story to tell and a greater challenge to resolve the contradictions in his personality.
Good. We'll come back to that. That's very interesting.
A third way that the new biography is different than what came before is we have a lot more historical perspective on Rogers and the person-centered approach after 25 or 30 years. So I think it was I've done a much better job this time, I hope, in setting some of Rogers' life and work and his accomplishments and his legacy in a historical context. Mm-hmm. And by the same token, I hope I've grown a lot in the last 30 years or so in terms of my own understanding and maturity, so that hopefully whatever better understanding of the human condition I've gained in my own life and thinking is reflected in a more thoughtful, more balanced work. And then I'll mention just one last way that this book is different than the than On Becoming Carl Rogers, the 1979 biography, and that is this one is fully referenced and footnoted.
Mm-hmm.
And the previous biography was not. I had lots of footnotes and lots of references, but the publisher and I think mistakenly agreed back then that we wanted the work not to seem too stodgy and scholarly, and wanted it to be a more popular book. And I think that took away some of the gravitas of the work, and this one, I think, both for scholars who are interested in the details that appear in the footnotes, and for those who aren't, I think it's still useful for the footnotes and the references and the information on my sources to be fully laid out, because it's both useful for those who are interested in it and demonstrates a credibility for those who aren't. So it's really quite a different book. It's a lot longer.
Mm-hmm.
this is a long book and a very full picture of I hope of Rogers' life and work.
And the footnotes weren't too intrusive. As I was reading it, there were maybe four or five times I actually went back to find out what the footnote was. But for the most part, I didn't. I just kept reading through. So I think it was done very well.
Thanks. That was my goal.
Yeah. Okay, I'm going to ask you about the person-centered approach and how it's faring in the U.S. But before that, I wanted you to maybe, for those who are, of our listeners who need a little refresher, describe the person-centered approach.
The person-centered approach in the context of counseling and psychotherapy is an approach by which in which the relationship between the counselor and the client is paramount, is of paramount importance. Rogers described the therapeutic relationship as consisting of three necessary and sufficient conditions, as he described them, or three core conditions, let's say. The therapist's congruence or realness, the therapist's empathy for the client, that is, sensitive understanding of the world as the client experienced it, and third, an unconditional positive regard for the client, that is, a basic prizing and appreciation and respect for the client as a person of individual worth and autonomy. And if those conditions were offered by the therapist, that if the therapist could embody those core conditions and the client could perceive those conditions to at least the minimum degree, Rogers hypothesized, that then a relationship would be developed that would enable the client to grow and change in positive ways. Rogers changed his views. The client-centered approach changed a bit over the years. There was the period of non-directiveness. There was the period of client-centered therapy. There was the person-centered period. But essentially, at the core, at whatever stage Rogers was working, he demonstrated a respect for the client's autonomy, a belief that the client had the resources inside to grow and change in the ways that would be productive and helpful if the therapist could provide a supportive environment. And over the years, he clarified, both in terms of his own experience and with voluminous research, what those conditions were that supported the client's individual growth. So it was person-centered in the sense, or client-centered in the sense, that the client, it was not the outside expert directing, diagnosing, or directing the course of the client's sessions and progress, but it was the counselor serving as a helpful, supportive presence that would enable the client to do his or her own work, basically. And this was revolutionary when Rogers first introduced it. And to some extent, in these days of heavy reliance on diagnoses and treatment plans planned out by the professionals, it's still a revolutionary proposition.
It is revolutionary. And I always thought of Carl Rogers as having a very pure belief in the goodness of people and in the possibility that each person could arrive at their own answers if the situation around them was was positive, if deep listening was taking place. That people could move towards that place inside of them where they actually had the answer. What a positive view of humankind to believe that that were so.
It was a positive view of human nature. He never came out and said human beings are basically good. He was aware of the complexity of the human experience and human condition, but he did say the human being is basically trustworthy in the sense that when provided with the positive conditions for growth, it was almost inevitable, he probably would have said inevitable, that humans will grow in ways that are self-actualizing, in ways that are good for themselves and the society around them, mm-hmm. that it was when social conditions and the social context was negative that the human personality became warped. And he often used an analogy of the potatoes growing in the cellar when he was a young boy growing up on a farm,
mm-hmm.
and they would sprout shoots up toward the daylight and grow in the most kind of warped and distorted fashion to meet their own needs, because it was the best they could do under the circumstances they were in, and that human beings have that same self-actualizing tendency. They want to grow. They want to have good social relationships. They want to enhance their lives and those around them, but often the conditions distort their growth. And so Rogers was a very firm, and in this sense, as you said, a very optimistic, had a very optimistic viewpoint that if the therapist or the counselor in the context of a counseling relationship could provide the nurturing conditions for growth, that clients would move in positive directions.
Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more. How has the Rogers' work, the person-centered approach to counseling and psychotherapy, been faring in the U.S. and around the world in recent years?
Well, there's an irony here. In the U.S., I think Rogers' approach and the person-centered approach is alive and well to the extent that it's one of the major theories taught in counseling theories courses and clinical psychology courses of study and in personality textbooks and so on. So Rogers is a foundational theory in the history of psychology and the helping professions.
Mm-hmm.
But the person-centered approach has not done well as an explicit theory that people are trained in and to any significant degree or have any real understanding of in any depth. That's my impression in the U.S. And that is very different than around the world, particularly in Europe, where the person-centered approach is one of the leading, and in some countries, the leading approach to counseling and psychotherapy. In England, for example, or in Austria, which is Sigmund Freud's home country, the person-centered approach is considered probably the leading approach to counseling and psychotherapy. And by leading, what I mean is it's taught in as a distinct approach in institutes and universities. People get their counseling degree in as a person-centered counselor. They're funded by the and reimbursed by insurance companies and recognized by governmental agencies as one of the empirically supported treatments. There are widespread publications. There are professional associations with 1,000 to 4,000 members in many of the countries. In other words, it's an extraordinarily active, alive, growing movement.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the United States, after Roger's death, I think there was a slackening of interest in the person-centered approach per se, although that has changed somewhat, I think, since the 100th anniversary of Roger's birth in 2002, when there was a good deal of activity and some new books, new work. But there's a long way to go, and I say it's ironic because, of course, in Roger's home country, his work is less influential than in many places around the world. But I think that may be changing, and people will be rediscovering Roger's. And if we get to talk about some of the research on the person-centered approach, I could give a couple of examples of how I think people, even in other schools of thought, are rediscovering the validity of many aspects of the person-centered approach.
An interesting thing that just came to mind as you were speaking is I remember some 20 years ago when I was initially getting my master's in counseling that this was presented more as a strategy. So, in other words, I had, I was taught all these different clinical strategies, and this was one of them, and this was some 20 years ago, and then as I went on to practice, I remember that I used to think Carl Rogers always gives me a fallback position. So, in other words, if I couldn't think of anything else to do in the middle of a session, and I could always go to reflective listening, to the unconditional positive regard. I could go to these strategies, and what I'm hearing you say now is that in other countries, it's much more than a strategy. It's something you would get a degree or a certificate in specifically. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. I think your experience is shared by many people in the U.S. and around the world. That is, we recognize on some level that the foundation for any good therapeutic work, for whether your approach is cognitive behavioral or existential or whatever it may be,
mm-hmm.
that it's necessary to form a positive therapeutic relationship or a therapeutic alliance or a therapeutic bond with the client. And Rogers was the pioneer really in popularizing a concept for what the therapeutic relationship consisted of. And over decades, he explicated and explored with new nuances the meaning of establishing a therapeutic relationship with clients so that it's for many practitioners, that's the foundation of their work. They recognize, and so, some people it's as explicit as, well, for the first session or two, I mostly listen. I mostly establish that relationship. I demonstrate empathy. I demonstrate positive regard and prizing of the client, you know. And then some counselors and some therapists say, and then I get to do my work. I get to do my approach. I start asking the questions. I start intervening. I start making I start confronting the client in this way or that way. So they see the person-centered relationship as a beginning and as a foundation, and as you said, something to fall back on when all else fails. So to that extent, Roger's work is alive and well in the U.S. But for many people in the U.S. and around the world, and certainly for Carl Rogers, he went further than that. He said that this therapeutic relationship, these core conditions, were not only necessary, which is what we were saying up until now, but they are sufficient that the therapeutic relationship, when implemented in a meaningful way, is healing in itself. To be understood deeply by another human being does more and accepted and prized for who you are once you're understood deeply, does more for a person's self-concept and confidence than many strategies could accomplish. Rogers and the places in Europe and Japan and Brazil and Argentina that teach the person-centered approach as a sufficient approach, they spend their time teaching counselors how to make the person-centered approach a way of being, to use one of Roger's phrases, in relationship, in all relationships, in counseling relationships, in teaching relationships, in all helping relationships, and all human relationships, that way of being is freeing and contributes to people's personality change, growth, creativity, learning, and so on. So I think this is an important distinction. Those who see the person-centered approach as sort of a means toward an end, as enabling real therapy to start taking place by using specific techniques, and those who see the person-centered approach or the person-centered relationship as the core, the essence of counseling and psychotherapy.
That's fascinating. To shift gears for a moment, you knew Rogers pretty well, and you've been a student of Rogers' work for many decades. Were you surprised by anything you learned about him personally in writing the new biography?
Well, we could come back now to the subject of alcohol that I mentioned before, and we could come back to a number of other areas. Yeah, I was very surprised. And there's sort of a contradiction here. Rogers was one of the most congruent people I know. He lived his theories. He was open. He felt life was richest when he was sharing himself openly and honestly with others, whether that was in small group work or in large group work. Even eventually in individual counseling, he shared more and more of himself by being congruent with his clients. And he was known for that. He was considered a role model of openness and honesty in his pioneering the encounter group movement. He was one of the leaders of this movement, and particularly in the 1970s, for more authentic human relationships, the dropping of facades, being a fully functioning person. So while this was true, he was also a private person who kept some areas of his life quite private. And so even in writing his first biography, I just knew the first side. But as I delved more deeply into researching his work using the some of the restricted diaries and interviews with people who knew him very well, discovered that there was a lot more going on. I mentioned the alcoholism. Well, other than his children, even his closest colleagues did not know that he felt the need to drink a good deal throughout the day and in the evening to calm himself to sleep. But of course, the alcohol had just the opposite effect. It made him more difficult to sleep. And he was extremely high functioning throughout the day. There was absolutely no evidence in throughout his personal relationships. There was no evidence that he had any difficulty or problem with alcohol. But at night, the demons came out. Issues from his past. He, in terms of his mental health, it was a great contradiction. He had he did not have a sense of peace within himself. There were old scars from his childhood that although he worked on often throughout his life, even in his 80s, is getting help in with other counselors and therapists that he knew, he never quite got over some of the issues he was struggling with, but it didn't appear to affect his behavior in most of his waking life. Yet when he was alone, he would become brooding and depressed. And so that was one example of he was still congruent. He just wasn't sharing everything about his private life with us. Mm-hmm. Another surprise was his spiritual journey.
Yes, I remember reading about him being at Union Theological Seminary, and that surprised me. I didn't know about that part of his life.
Well, that's the part that most people do know about, because he wrote about that in terms of his early background. He was raised by fundamentalist Christian parents, and he went to the Liberal Union Theological Seminary, which was quite radical from the point of view of his conservative background. But he quickly
weren't that delighted about that choice. Is that correct?
No, they weren't delighted at all. In fact, his father tried to bribe him and said if he went to the conservative Princeton Theological Seminary, he'd pay for Rogers' graduate education. But Rogers wouldn't have any of that, and he went off to Union Theological Seminary and paid his own way.
Mm-hmm.
But then his father relented and helped out. But that showed Rogers' independence, and it foreshadowed Rogers becoming disgusted with organized religion, totally, and essentially becoming an atheist or agnostic for most of his life. He really didn't want to have much to do with religion. But in his later years, he became very interested, particularly when his wife Helen, his wife of over 50 years, mm-hmm. was dying. They had a number of experiences with psychics and mystics that intrigued him about the possibility of consciousness surviving beyond individual's death, with the possibility of transcending the individual boundaries and connecting with a greater, larger transcendental reality, God, if you will. And for a period of about 4 or 5 years in particular, although less intensely over a period of about a decade, he gave serious consideration to these possibilities of and had many experiences with the paranormal, many of which he explained away by being the scientific skeptic that he was, but not all. He had a number of experiences he couldn't explain away, and so in his later years, he not only had these personal experiences, he wrote a number of essays such as The Formative Tendency that were stretching the boundaries of the person-centered approach and stretching the boundaries of his philosophy about the nature of human beings in this world. So that was, I had lots of surprises in learning about this journey of his with the Brazilian spiritualists and with painters who channeled the Toulouse-Lautrec and Degas and so on, and in his meetings with Swami Muktananda, just very rich and interesting anecdotes, which I think raise, you know, many of the questions that we all or most of us struggle with as we try to make sense of the universe.
One of the things I love about your book is that I came away with the feeling that Carl Rogers was utterly and completely human, just like me, with flaws. I love that about your book. And one other thing that I certainly had never heard about was his relationship with the CIA.
With I missed that word. With what?
The CIA.
Yes, with the Central Intelligence Agency.
Yeah.
Yep, that was a whole other fascinating episode, which, again, hardly anyone, I would say literally no one that I knew and talked to was aware of, even his own daughter, Natalie.
Yes.
And part of that is when he got involved with the CIA in the 1950s through a front organization called the Society for Human Ecology. He was had to pledge secrecy. And he honored that secrecy until various revelations about some of the nefarious deeds of the CIA came to light in the 70s, and he was released from his secrecy oath. And then he did give a couple of interviews on it, which never got widely reported. So for me, and I think for most readers like yourself, it was a whole new revelation to hear that the man who debated B.F. Skinner about the prediction and control of human behavior, the man who probably became the leader in the helping professions arguing for the cautious use of science and technology in and the cautious use of psychology and the behavioral sciences for manipulating people in society, that this man who in a sense became the voice and conscience for the behavioral sciences to be used in humane ways, had for a period of time been working with the CIA to help them understand, for example, how they might use questioning techniques to get more information from prisoners or from those they were interrogating. Now, Rod, but I should say very, very quickly that Rogers, that's what the CIA wanted from Rogers. Mm-hmm. That's not what Rogers wanted to do with the CIA. Mm-hmm. He simply, he believed, as people did at the time, this is in the height of the Cold War, mm-hmm. when Russia was regarded by many people as a significant threat to the U.S.,
right.
he wanted to be of help to the U.S. government if he could, mm-hmm. and he had pioneered a method of counseling that seemed to create such a sense of safety that people would be willing to share with the therapist and or the counselor in short order much about their inner lives. So Rogers simply wanted to continue doing his own work, and the CIA was quite interested in the implications of that for interrogation. But Rogers himself never did anything, from what I could unearth in my research, he never did anything that today we would regard as unethical, even by today's strict standards about ethics. In his own work, he was very scrupulous, and for example, when he was working with a woman with schizophrenia, mm-hmm. and he was trying to see, he was learning how by using sodium amytal the person might be more willing to reveal their inner life and inner feelings, mm-hmm. He was very troubled by the fact that afterwards they might have really real regrets about what they had revealed, and so he stopped using it in his own work because he felt that was unethical, and mm-hmm. so he didn't produce much of interest, therefore, for the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
But he got to know the inner workings to some extent of what the CIA was involved with, including some pretty unscrupulous experiments with LSD and other areas. And so I think I couldn't prove it, but I think his experience with the CIA helped him become more aware of the dangers of using the behavioral sciences to manipulate and control human beings, and it contributed to his becoming an outstanding spokesperson for and counterpoint to the B.F. Skinner and those who would use science and psychology to reinforce desirable behaviors and extinguish undesirable behaviors in people and society. So I think that was one of the great ironies of history of psychology, that Rogers actually worked with the CIA that way.
When I was reading the portion about the CIA, another thing occurred to me, because your book is so fascinating in the breadth of information that's shared regarding Rogers, certainly anecdotally, interesting personal stories, straight through his, he was actually what I would call a rigorous scientist in many ways. And it was so interesting to me to think about him as a child cataloging bugs. I thought that was so interesting, because it's almost like he had a little scientist in him when he was very young.
Yes, he did. It was there were two experiences in his youth that foreshadowed his later pioneering work in the science of psychology. And one was what you mentioned. He became an avid collector of butterflies and moths, and developed a large collection which he categorized and mounted and so on. Mm-hmm. And the other was his experiences with scientific agriculture, mm-hmm. where growing up on a farm, on a very large gentleman's farm, but no less a real farm, his father gave them a few acres, he and his brothers, to cultivate, and Rogers, kind of on his own by reading Morrison's Feeds and Feeding, the major tome on scientific agriculture those days, he learned how to conduct a scientific experiment, planting some rows this way and other rows that way, using different feeding and watering schedules and measuring the results. So he actually learned the basics of scientific experimentation as a youth, and later on when he became interested in measuring the progress of counseling and psychotherapy, he had a sort of an innate feel for the process, and he did go on in the 50s and 60s to do more research on counseling and psychotherapy than had ever been undertaken before, more scientific research, experimental research, quasi-experimental research, naturalistic studies, and he and his graduate students were real pioneers in this area, and Rogers was the first psychologist to win the American Psychological Association's Distinguished Scientific Contribution mm-hmm. Award for his pioneering work in counseling and psychotherapy.
That brings to mind another question I had for you regarding research. What has more recent research on counseling and psychotherapy revealed about the effectiveness of the person-centered approach?
In the last decade or two, a growing amount of research has indicated that it's not any particular approach to psychotherapy that's more effective than another, mm-hmm. but it's the basic therapeutic relationship which is most responsible for growth and change in counseling and psychotherapy. There's been numerous studies to that effect, both meta-analyses and individual studies. For example, in the very famous National Institute of Mental Health study that compared three major approaches to therapy and counseling, cognitive behavioral approach, an interpersonal approach, and I'm forgetting the third one right now, but they compared that with basic play and recreation for the patients. They discovered that one approach wasn't more effective than another, but the greatest predictor of effective outcomes in psychotherapy was the degree to which the client experienced the therapist as being empathic. And this was known by the second interview. And this has been repeated many times, studied by Bloxma and his colleagues in a hospital in which they used cognitive behavioral therapy to as their primary mode of treatment. They discovered that if the client was not experiencing the therapist as being empathic, the work wasn't effective, and it so shocked them that the earliest and best predictor of effectiveness in the cognitive behavioral therapy they were using was the degree to which the client felt understood by the counselor, caused the hospital to change its protocol and to give a client, after every interview, a small questionnaire asking them how well they felt understood by the therapist so that they would be able to use that to repair any ruptures in the therapeutic relationship. So those are just two studies, but there have been numerous studies that have shown that the reasons that therapeutic change or change occurs after counseling is a lot of it has to do with nothing about the therapeutic relationship at all. It's extra therapeutic factors such as the person's resilience that they bring to it, the relationship or the support system the person has back home. But after that, the greatest predictor of whether there's positive change in counseling or psychotherapy is in the quality of the therapeutic relationship. Sometimes it's described as the therapeutic alliance. Others have described it as the contract between the counselor and the psychotherapist. But whichever model you use, Rogers' core conditions play an important part. That seems to have the second greatest effect on outcomes. And the particular approach used in some circumstances can add an additional few percentage points of variance in terms of the effectiveness of the therapy or counseling. But the type of approach you use turns out to be much less important than the quality of the therapeutic relationship, as Rogers described it. So that's why I say that the latest generation of scientific research on counseling and psychotherapy has validated many of Rogers and the person-centered approach's original claims. And that's one reason I think there's a renewed interest in the person-centered approach across different theories of psychotherapy.
Well, your book is certainly going to contribute to that renewed interest because I felt a renewed interest after all of these years reading your book. I absolutely did. And we're going to wind this interview to a close soon. But before we do, I'd like you to give us some little personal story of your relationship or your time with Carl Rogers as a colleague and a friend, because that's one of the things that makes this book so fascinating. It's not only is it well-researched and, bringing to light all of this new information about Rogers, But the fact that you actually knew him makes it really more rich. So can you share with us some little story about Carl Rogers and you and your personal interaction?
Well, the one that comes to mind first is my very first meeting with Rogers. This was back, I guess it was 1970, the summer. I had driven across the country to meet him in California because, as a graduate student, I was looking for a subject for my dissertation, and I decided, I had read a bit of Rogers and was fascinated by him, and I wanted to know more about him and looked for a biography and didn't see one, so I thought maybe I could write a biography of Rogers as my dissertation, a bit non-traditional, but I thought maybe I could get away with that. And so I wrote to him and sent him some samples of my writings up until then. And he wrote back and said that, he had gotten several requests to do that, but up until now he hasn't been interested, but maybe I'd be the one he would be willing to cooperate with, that is, allow me to interview him and give me access to his files and so on. But he said, let's meet. So I drove across the country to meet him, and we sat down in his study, and for about 45 minutes I talked about myself and my background and my interests and how I visualized the biography and so on. And, you know, he listened politely and nodded his head and asked a few questions, and then he said, let's go out and meet Helen, his wife, who is also very interested in the subject of who might work with him on a biography. And so we went out to the living room and sat down with Helen, and Rogers proceeded to summarize, without notes, what I had been saying for the last 45 minutes. He told Helen about me and about my interests and what I had done and how I visualized the biography, and I sat there listening, thinking with amazement, and said, my God, this guy is a fantastic listener. I'm just so amazed. And then I started laughing at myself, because why should I have been surprised? I drove across the country because this man was the founder of the Client Centered Approach to Psychotherapy and Counseling, and here he was demonstrating it for me. And
That's a wonderful story.
Yeah, I always remembered that, and a good example of how he really was the person he wrote about. He modeled the philosophy and the approach to counseling that he advocated, and I think that's one reason he was so influential for at least two generations or three generations of professionals, is because he was such a vivid role model.
Absolutely. That's a great story, and I want to thank you, Dr. Howard Kirschenbaum, for joining me today to discuss your fascinating book, The Life and Work of Carl Rogers. Please go to the American Counseling Association's website at www.counseling.org and click on the podcast page for all associated links and to write to the author and the host of this podcast. This is Rebecca Daniel Burke, your host of the ACA 2009 podcast series, signing off.